In Dublin's fair city, where the girls are so pretty, I first laid my eyes on sweet Molly Malone. As she wheeled her wheelbarrow through the streets broad and narrow, crying cockles and mussels,
Sinead O'Connor's version of Molly Malone or Cockles and Mussels. It's a song that has become an anthem for Dublin and one of the few in our series which is about a woman. A Molly herself now stands with her cart outside Trinity College. I'm Therese McIntyre, and in this episode of Hero Songs, I'm exploring the songs of invented heroes. Songs which often make us think these are real flesh and blood people, like Molly herself or Michael, in what has become Ireland's sporting anthem, The Fields of Athenry.
By a lonely prison wall, I heard a young girl calling. Michael, they have taken you away, for you stole Trevelyan's corn, so the young might see the morn. Now a prison ship lies waiting in the bay.
Paddy Riley with The Fields of Athenry, a famine song now more sung by Irish crowds than the national anthem. And then there's an anti-war song, No Man's Land, and the World War I Irish soldier, Willie McBride.
Well, how do you do, Private William McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside and rest for a while neath the warm summer sun? I've been walking all day and I'm nearly done. I can see by your gravestone you were only 19 when you joined the Great Fallin in 1916.
Pat Woods there singing No Man's Land. So have these songs, both old like Molly Malone and relatively new like The Fields of Athenry and No Man's Land, given life to these characters? And why are they so powerful as anthems? So much so that in many ways we want to believe they are the stories of real people drawn from our history. I asked music scholar and singer John Molden just why he thinks they work.
These things are nearly all emotional. And even for someone like me who's been researching songs, the emotional is still by far the strongest thing that moves me. These songs are brilliant songs to sing. These are brilliant songs to impart emotion. These are brilliant songs to impart a whole raft of feelings about who we are, where we come from, who represents us, and that they represent also a way in which we can speak very powerfully about ourselves.
So does it matter if the characters in song are made up? If Molly, Michael, and Willie McBride are real or invented? Mike Cronin at Boston College here in Dublin thinks not.
In a way, it doesn't matter whether Willie McBride was real. The important thing about all these songs is they capture a historic truth. These things happened. In terms of the song, their kind of hero appeal is they are embodiments of a historic moment, an identity, a city, a nation. And that's their appeal. That's why people want to sing about them. The more they sing about them and the more they hear about them, people then want them to be real.
So Molly Malone is one of the rare statues of a woman in Dublin City. And the song is often first on the lips when a sing-song begins. In Dublin, I'm here at the statue at the foot of Grafton Street and curious as to what people think about her and about the song itself.
I mean, I heard about it in primary school and we used to sing it all the time, but I haven't really heard it since.
It's a great song. It's a kind of tourist song, but it's great.
It's a song for the city. Yeah, it's lasted, you know, more than other songs.
Molly Malone, one of the biggest landmarks in Dublin City, great meeting point, tart with a cart.
Well, she was supposedly sold fish, and that was during the day, and then during the night, I understand she made herself available to gentlemen.
I know that she was a single woman, as far as the story goes, who sold her wares in the streets, but by night sold more wares. I like to think she's real. Obviously, she's probably an exaggerated version of the real person, but yeah, I'd say there's definitely truth in her.
She was in Moore Street, she was. Well known for Moore Street, where they do all the fish and all.
I think I'm named Molly, that's how I know. People used to call me Molly Malone.
Molly Malone?
Yeah.
In St. Louis, we have a big parade for Molly Malone.
Well, she's real, I think. Isn't she?
There you have it. A lot of people believe she existed, or as one woman said, I'd like to think she's real. Now, there's no concrete evidence that Molly Malone was a real person, or even that she was a prostitute, as some suggest. I asked Mike Cronin who he thinks Molly Malone represents.
Molly Malone is a kind of identikit figure of women who work the streets of Dublin. She's this kind of composite figure that speaks to what the city was like. She has her own narrative that ends in her sad death. Things like the statue and so on are quite important, that it's actually Dublin's millennium in 1988 where the statue is erected. Therefore, we now have the real Molly Malone. We know what she looks like. I mean, it doesn't matter if she looked like that or not. We have this image now. Molly Malone is a thing. She's made real.
If there's no evidence that Molly Malone was a real person, what do we know of the song itself? John Molden.
Molly Malone, or Cockles and Mussels. Although it's so strongly associated with Dublin, and it may be regarded as the Dublin anthem, is not an Irish song. It was written by a Scot, a man called James Yorkston, although he may have been imitating an earlier song by another foreigner, an Englishman called Gagan, although that's an Irish name, but he was an English music hall performer called Alive Alive-O. But James Yorkston first published the song sometime in the 1860s, and it has been taken up and is now regarded as the quintessential Dublin song, and all sorts of myths have grown up about it, mainly due to an attempt to explain the appearance of the tart with the cart. And there has even been an attempt to associate the Molly Malone of that song with the Molly Malone of another song, completely different in kind, which has absolutely nothing to do with it. There are at least three or four songs which use the words Molly Malone as being the name of their hero. Is Your Mother in Molly Malone? Is another of them, a music hall song. So these two songs, which are associated, have nothing whatsoever to do with them, but the one which has been recently uncovered and presented to the Dublin Writers' Museum shows Molly Malone in the guise of a rather racy lady of the town, and this fits for people with the image of the tart with the cart, and so it's become accepted that this song tells of the same person. What person? There's no evidence whatsoever that Molly Malone was a real person. Just a sound or a series of sounds. Molly Malone, two syllables and two syllables. Easy to sing, easy to say, but meaning nothing.
So Molly could be many women. Like Billy Murray's 1906 recording of Is Your Mother in Molly Malone? A song published in 1790 is called Sweet Molly Malone and tells of a Molly living in Howth. Some see the root of Molly Malone in a 17th century character and song, but our Molly is very much a composite figure, an everywoman. The song has been adapted and sung by artists as varied as Bono, Bing Crosby, and baritone Bryn Terfel. But here's jazz trumpeter Charlie Shaver and Maxine Sullivan with theirs.
He asked her to marry, she said it would be grand, but to leave her dear Dublin, she'd not give her hand. So they both wheel a barrow through streets wide and narrow, crying cockles and mussels, alive, alive, oh.
Charlie Shaver and Maxine Sullivan with their happy ending version of Molly Malone. Shannon singer Noreen Irene learnt a traditional Gaelic version, which gives a whole different take on the song. She sees Molly Malone as an archetype for the hero song.
Hero songs bring together, of course, history, story, fiction, fact, because you look at a song like Molly Malone, that song has become part of our DNA, part of our psyche. Now, everywhere you will hear it. Anywhere I go, when I go to America, I say, look it, will you sing along with this? And they may not have our exact version, but they will have the live, alive, oh, alive, alive, oh, you know, and they can sing on. So that has become part of a universal tradition associated with Ireland. And for me, that particular song is really important because, of course, as you know, we learn that in school, you know, and you hate it because it just becomes mundane, like three blind mice, three blind mice. And we learn it off by heart and that was it. And you don't get any sense of it. But when we went to Ring to learn Irish, Nicholas Tobin was the great singer there at the time. And we had a harmonium that my mother had given us for as an engagement present. And the little knock would come in the window about 12 midnight. And Nicholas would come in and he'd be, as we say in this area, he'd be quite Killarney. But what he loved to sing, he didn't want to sing any of the big Shannon songs at that stage, but he loved to sing a version of Molly Malone in Irish. And every night he would do something different with that song, you know. So for me, it was a huge eye-opener into the richness, into the possibility of Shannon's. So this is Nicholas's version of it, and not at all, of course, as well or as beautifully as Nicholas could sing it. He used to sing it in Irish. I'm accompanying it on a little Indian harmonium, which is called a sarpeti. Tres roide his garo a de hru con is ligon shir pa I suppose hero songs, the thing about them is that they come alive in the performance of each singer. And every singer will interact either with the person about whom, the hero about the song, or the person with, from whom it came from. And for me, of course, I'm connecting up there with Nicholas Tobin, with his particular version. Because I would never have sung Molly Malone had I not received it through that source, which was unexpected.
Noreen Nireen. Unlike Molly Malone, we know exactly when The Fields of Athenry was written and who wrote it. It seems it's more sung than Auron na Bhfian, but these days, few of us know what it's about.
To me, it's the kind of song I think about when I walk down the street late at night and people are just pouring out of the pubs and they're just roaring that off the top of their heads.
Usually just hear it at every soccer match with Irish fans in it.
It's a song that's become kind of an anthem for sports teams and their fans, and it kind of represents Irishness abroad. I think it's something to do with the Easter Rising. I'm probably wrong.
I feel it reminds me of everyone standing up at a match with their arms in the air singing The Fields of Athenry. At the top are their voices, but most of them have probably never even been to Athenry.
The song reminds me of every GA match you went to, you sang the song, even if you didn't know the lyrics, you went along with it anyway.
It reminds me of the World Cup last year where everyone was singing it and it became famous around the world in Ireland.
By a lonely prison wall I heard a young girl calling. Michael, they are taking you away. For you stole Trevelyan's corn, so the young might see the morn. Now a prison ship lies waiting in the bay.
Some student voices in my own hometown of Galway, showing just how little they know about the song or its story, with Dominic Kerwin's version coming in there. The song is actually just 34 years old. It was written by composer Pete St. John and tells the story of Michael, an invented character from Athenry, who is convicted for stealing food for his family during the Great Famine, 1845-47, and transported to Australia. In an RTE television documentary in 2010, Pete St. John had this to say about his song, which has gone round the world, and about what inspired him.
When you think of the resilience and the determination and courage of the ones who left Ireland and emigrated to America, to Canada, all over the world, and made another life for themselves, I'm very proud of that spirit of the Irish people. And that's what I hope the Fields of Athenry as a song, a very sad song, true, the melody, the lyrics, just have to capture that folk consciousness that I feel is still in the Irish people. So when I hear the song sung, I feel I'm asking the Irish people to remember the famine and its victims.
Against the famine and the crown, I rebelled, they ran me down.
It is very nice to sit back in a large gathering of Irish and their friends anywhere in the world, not necessarily anyone knowing that I was the guy that wrote it or I'm there, just to hear the song sung. And if they sing it at the sporting events, may it continue.
The Fields of Athenry being sung there at Katie Taylor's gold-winning Olympic bout in London 2012. While Fields of Athenry is a modern song about the famine, there are many that were written not long after the events, like Skibbereen, published sometime in the 1880s and attributed to Patrick Carpenter, a song where a son asks his father why he left Ireland.
They say it is a lovely land wherein a prince might dwell. Oh, why did you abandon it? The reason to me tell.
Skibbereen, sung there by Colm O'Donnell. But what is it about the Fields of Athenry which has made it so popular? Grace Toland of the Irish Traditional Music Archive.
Why a song becomes popular can happen for so many reasons. Obviously, it's how many people can hear it, you know. So this song obviously was latched on to for the melody for one reason. It has a wonderful, repetitive, melodic melody. The Fields of Athenry, it personifies a period in Irish history that we can link very easily to. The fact that it was picked up by rugby players, by sporting people, but became a national anthem for some reason, it's a phenomenon that I can't actually explain myself or particularly understand why one song could be picked up so easily by a community.
The Dubliners there with the crowd pleaser, the Fields of Athenry.
Against the famine and the crown, I rebel, they cut me down. Now you must raise our child with dignity.
For Eric Bogle, who wrote our final song, No Man's Land, telling history through song is his passion.
Well, how to do, Private William McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your grey side?
Bogle wrote the song, which is also known as The Green Fields of France, in 1975. It's about an Irish soldier fighting in World War I.
All day long and I'm nearly done. I see by your gravestone you were only 19 when you joined the glorious fallen in 1916. Well, I hope you died quick, and I hope you died clean. Or Willie McBride, was it slow and obscene?
We're listening to Bogle's own and original version, and I caught up with the Scottish-born composer on the line from his home in Australia to get the story behind the song.
I visited northern France and Flanders in 1975, and I spent a couple of weeks wandering around the old battlefields and the graveyards and the monuments and all that sort of stuff, and it was very affecting. It affected me quite deeply. You read about the waste of war and the stupidity of it, but when you're faced with a graveyard full of thousands and thousands of young men, it brings it home quite sharply. I wanted to write, you know, about the experience of going around these graveyards. I picked the name Willie McBride purely at random. What I was hoping for when I picked the name, I was aware that McBride was a fairly common Irish name. It's not so common in Scotland. And at the time I wrote the song, the IRA, the mainland campaign in the UK, was in full swing and all the bombs were going off. People were being killed, and there was a very strong anti-Irish sentiment in Britain at the time. And I was hoping the name McBride would remind them in a subtle way that many Irishmen fought and died for king and country, or for just living wages probably, in World War I, as well as many English and Scots and all that sort of stuff. So that wasn't the premier reason for writing the song, it was just a little adjunct to it. The name was chosen to represent all the boys who were buried there. I subsequently found out that during World War I, 11 soldiers with the name Willie McBride were killed, which is a melancholy, if unsurprising, coincidence given the hundreds of thousands of young men who died. And at its premiere, its world premiere, in Hamilton Folk Club in Scotland way back in 1975. And that's the story behind the song.
The warm wind blows gently and the red poppies dance. The trenches have vanished long under the plough. No gas and no barbed wire, no guns firing now. But here in this graveyard, it's still no man's land. The countless white crosses in you'd witness stand.
It's estimated over 200,000 Irishmen fought in the British forces in World War I, and some 35,000 died. Eric Bogle references both The Last Post and the Scottish ballad, The Fields of the Forest. But while the song may have started humbly in a folk club, it became a major hit for the Furies, who changed the name of the song to The Green Fields of France.
I was quite surprised when people started to sing the song, and in quite considerable numbers, people started to take it up. And then the Furies got a hold of it, and the rest was history, as they say. Eddie and Fibber changed the title, of course, to The Greenfields of France, which is how the song is known better in Ireland and indeed other places in the world now, by that title, which doesn't bother me at all. The song's still the same.
Our young Willie McBride, was it slow and obscene? Did he beat the drum slowly? Did he play the fife slowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down?
I would hope that the lyrics of the song have the same effect no matter what you call the song. You know, that's why I don't object to the names being changed, really. And if it changed all the lyrics and made it something more or less hard-hitting, then I'd be upset.
Now, when I was a young man, I carried me pack, and I lived the free life of the rover. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback,
I waltzed my Matilda all over.
Eric Bogle wrote No Man's Land as an anti-war song, like his earlier song and the band played Waltzing Matilda. It tells the story of an Australian soldier during the devastation of Gallipoli, and which has itself become an alternative anthem for his adopted country.
I'm trying to get an emotion across here, an emotion of sorrow and loss and anger, you know, and question why did this all happen and why did all these young men have to die? No matter what war is being sung about, whether it be, you know, way back in the Hundred Years' War, Napoleonic, First, Second, Iraq, Afghanistan, the end result tends to be the same, you know, a lot of young lives totally wasted. So the song retains melancholy enough, a relevance for the years.
But as year follows year, more old men disappear. Someday no one will march there at all. Waltzing Matilda, waltzing Matilda, who'll come a waltzing Matilda with me? And our ghosts may be heard as they march by the billabong. Who'll come a waltzing Matilda with me?
The Clancy Brothers' gorgeous version of Eric Bogle's and the band played Waltzing Matilda, closing with the folk song written at the end of the 19th century. Next week, I'm exploring ballads of sport and a champion hero song horse, Arkell.
It happened in the springtime of the year of 64, when Englishmen were making pounds and fivers by the score. He beat them on the hollows, he beat them on the jumps, a pair of fancy fetlocks, will he show them all?